Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or RutabagaShop.com.
Talking climate and weather now with our two guests. With me in the studio, Professor John Martin, who chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And with us by phone today, the world traveler Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And Steve, you're on the road.
I'm on the road. I'm up in the famous international traveler is up in Moqua, up in Wisconsin, just right near Ashland.
Right near Ashland. Oh, yeah. And you're traveling around the state with some teachers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we got a busload of 28 teachers from Wisconsin. We had gotten a Baldwin grant to do what's called a Here at Home tour. So we're taking these 28 teachers on a 9-day tour of Wisconsin and learning about the geography and weather and local culture and how they might use all that stuff in their classroom when they teach our wonderful children.
Ah, wonderful. Well, that sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a great trip. It's been a great group of teachers, great group of people. Because, you know, I mean, like I'm sitting here in somebody's home. They let me call in and go to talk to you guys. So, I mean, I'm sure that's how nice they are. I don't know if you guys appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, they're certainly not in the know.
And he left me here alone.
Well, tell you what, if somebody else wants to call in, they can do that at 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area at 263-1890. Call if you got a question about climate or weather. We'll be glad to get you on the air. You know, last month, Steve, just before 12:30, you referred to enhanced satellite imagery that's now available in terms of tracking storms. And a caller responded by saying it was his observation that the more instruments forecasters get to use, the worse the forecasts become. And we sort of promised that you would respond to that assessment during today's show.
Yeah, and I guess we're lucky we ran out of time because I think John and I were both upset because actually weather forecasters have been getting better and significantly better over the last 20, 30 years. And I'd say it's primarily due to three things. One is improved instrumentation, I mean radars and satellites and what we call wind profilers, which can continuously measure the wind over a given location in the U.S. So getting that data coupled with improved model forecasts or computer models plus an improved understanding of how the atmosphere works has allowed us to get better forecasts. And, you know, we tend to remember the bad ones. And so if people don't believe it, they should just keep track.
Yeah.
You know, look at the forecast for the next day and then see how it verified. And I think you'll find that generally the forecasts, particularly of temperature, are done really, really well.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more with the last piece that you just must keep score. If you want to be a critic of the 1 to 2 day forecast, you have got to keep score because you're going to find that 90% of the time, even now in the summertime, you're going to get a pretty good forecast. And the thing I think that makes people maybe disbelieve that or have a bias against it is the fact that the media now tries to push the 3 to 5 to 7 day forecasts. They never did that 10 years ago. You never even heard about a 7 day forecast. And our 2 day forecast now is about as accurate, or in those days, is about as accurate as our 3 or 4 day forecast is today. So we're right about 80% of the time, 90% of the time, and you can verify it. You don't have to take our word for it. Just keep score.
Yeah. And actually, that's the other nice thing that's really changed recently in modern times is not just the data and being able to make the observations, but being able to get that out into the public.
Yeah.
So people can go get those measurements. They
that's
don't
right.
have to believe us.
That's right.
Well, all right. I think you've answered that very well.
We were kind of hot that day, right, Steve?
Yeah, we've got a good
jumping out of our seats.
Put it off, actually.
Yeah.
Somebody wondered. Here's a question from somebody who wondered about dew points. We talk about dew points on the program. What is a dew point?
The dew point is defined as the following: it's the temperature to which the air has to be cooled, keeping the pressure constant, before you reach saturation. So you're actually going to start to get some dew drops when you get to saturation. So the air has water vapor in it. And it, depending on how much water vapor there is, it will determine how much you have to cool it before it'll start to condense that water vapor. On a day like today, I don't know what it's like up near Ashland, Steve, but here we got a dew point almost 70.
Wow.
And it's you walk outside and it feels like you're in a bath when the breeze blows by you, because there's so much water vapor in that air that it's loaded with what we call latent heat. And if you can and you get a combination of both the air temperature and the high humidity level, and it leads to discomfort.
What's the when do the dew points begin making people feel uncomfortable? It's certainly lower than 70, I would think.
Yeah, I think it depends on the person. Everybody's going to have a little bit of a different opinion, but my own opinion, and Steve can tell you his, is anything above about 61 or 62, I start to notice that. And anything in the 70s, almost everybody notices that. So that's extremely uncomfortable dew points. You know, we're right in that right now. What about you, Steve? What's your cutoff?
Yeah, we're actually in the mid-70s up here, and our dew point's in the mid-60s, and I can just barely handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like humid weather.
Yeah.
I'd much rather be bone dry than humid in any way.
Well, let's find out what Earl in Sussex, I think, may have a question relating or comment relating to dew point. Earl, hello.
Hi. Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. But, I noticed that my breathing changes with the weather, and I was just wondering where a person could find out what the dew point is and what other weather-related conditions could cause for breathing, and where the person could get the readings for the dew point and the ozone number.
Mm.
Is there a place that one could call in the state or something for that information?
I would guess if you call the National Weather Service, and I don't know their phone number off the top of my head, I'm sure it's in the phone book, they would probably report the most proximate temperature and dew point. I don't know if they give the ozone value. That's a very good question. I don't know where you would get that. And with a high dew point, there's a lot of water vapor in the air, and so a smaller percentage of every breath you take is actually oxygen and other gases that you're going to use when there's a lot of water vapor in the air. A slightly higher percentage is water vapor, and you can't respire with that water vapor in the air quite as well. But the ozone, I don't know. Steve, do you know?
Yeah, I think if you have the internet, Earl, I think if you look on the EPA site, I think the EPA will generally publish ozone, at least for cities. I don't know if they'll do, you know, interpolate a whole map so you can get it for every city in the upper Midwest.
Now, we're in the Milwaukee area, so I think that would be, we're near the Milwaukee, so that would be probably along with that. But the EPA site, you say?
Yeah, if you search on the EPA, and I'm pretty sure the EPA has a couple of sites in Milwaukee. Because I know they keep track of aerosols, fine particles in the atmosphere, and they have different sites, and I know they have a couple in Milwaukee. Mm.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thanks very much for calling. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Let's see. Last week, I was out golfing late afternoon, and I heard some thunder.
Mm.
Didn't see any lightning, but we continued on, and actually kind of cleared up after the fact. But if you hear thunder, can you be struck by lightning?
Yeah, I think the answer to that, the prudent answer is yes. You know, there might be somebody who would say there's going to be circumstances under which you might hear thunder from very, very distant place, and you got no risk at all of a lightning strike. But I just think that's not safe. It's more prudent to be careful if you hear some thunder that you're probably somewhat under the gun, some degree of being under the gun. What do you think about that, Steve?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, Larry, I can't believe you're on that radio saying, yeah, we heard it and we kept playing.
Well, it looked like it was going to clear up.
Setting a good example.
Yeah, I had a good round going.
Right. Well, that's it. I mean, we all, if you can hear lightning, then you're...
Or hear thunder.
Or hear thunder, yeah, sorry. Yeah, if you can hear lightning, then you're really in trouble.
Yeah, and Oh, sorry, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, if you can hear thunder, then generally you at risk of getting hit by it. Now, what is the probability? You know, there you have to balance it with your own decisions about whether or not you want to take that risk. But if you're doing a good golf game, it's probably really hard to walk away.
Yeah, yeah. I think MSCR softball, and I'm pretty sure West Madison Little League baseball, has the rule that if you hear thunder on the field, you're off the field.
Right.
And certainly if you see the lightning first before the thunder, you're off the field as well.
And they leave that decision now, I think, to the umpires. Because I remember a couple of years ago before they had that rule, you know, we were like, you know, in the bottom of the sixth, and we were winning. And we heard lightning, and it was just like, no, let's just play one more inning.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the other team.
We wanted to walk away with the win.
Mark in Evansville, let's go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hello, guys. How you doing today?
Good.
Good. I'm kind of wondering what the hurricanes are supposed to be like down near the Atlantic. I am moving to Georgia on Friday. I'm kind of concerned.
Hmm.
Any kind of outlook on any of that? Or
I think they're talking about 5 named storms or maybe 7 named storms this year, and with the guess that one of them will hit the United States. But I don't know how that varies from what the normal forecast issued in May and June is. I've never heard of a forecast in the early part of the year that says well below normal activity or something like that. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, that's what I've heard too, is that it's just about normal, maybe a little bit above below normal, I should say, with regard to the numbers. But I haven't, since I've been traveling, I haven't gotten on to look and seen if there are any tropical storms or hurricanes brewing. Are there any down there now?
No, we had Tropical Storm Andrea, or maybe it was even just a depression, and that was very early. That was in early May.
Right. Yeah.
And that's been the only one so far this year, I think.
Okay.
Mark, where are you moving to in Georgia?
Savannah.
Oh, Savannah. What a great city.
Yeah.
Beautiful city.
You know, Mark, you're just above 30 degrees north at Savannah, so the hurricane risk on at coastal Georgia is so much different than it is for coastal Florida. I mean, it's night and day. In fact, Jacksonville, as part of Florida, has a completely different hurricane history than the rest of the state. So there's some encouragement there.
All right.
And Mark, do you like high dew points?
I was just down there a couple weeks ago. I know exactly what you mean.
Yep. Big bugs like high dew points, too.
other than the hurricanes and the bugs and the high dew points, you'll be just fine.
It is a great city.
Good luck. You know, you can listen to us online while you're down there.
Definitely. Thank
you. All right.
You.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, my goodness. Nate in Green Bay. Hi to you.
Hello. Thank you for your contribution to my understanding of weather. I have a question that is more related to latitude and longitude than anything, I suppose, but I thought I'd ask and see what you were able to come up with. I was in a book discussion a couple of days ago when our days are getting shorter now, and I am wondering, is it possible to travel north or south some short distance each day to maintain the length of the day? For instance, if the day is 15 hours and 20 minutes, if I go south a certain distance or north a certain distance in the course of the next months, would I be able to maintain the length of the day if I wanted to?
Tell you what, we'll ponder that and think about it while we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at climate and weather now here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, my guests, with me by phone, Professor Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and Professor John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Some interesting questions to talk about, and certainly we hope you'll join in with your questions as well. We're going to talk a little bit more about lightning and thunder. What about if you know, the days are getting shorter now. What if you, is there some way that you can drive north or south and make the days stay the same for you in your position? Well, we're having Steve and John ponder that question as well. You have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And we'll be right back after this look at the news. Talking climate and weather now with our guests with me by phone today, Steve Martin, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and Professor John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW. Pleased to have them with us, and certainly you're welcome to join in with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's take up this question of the length of day. Let's say here we are in Madison, Wisconsin, the daylight is at such and such a time. Mm-hmm. Can I extend my daylight? You know, it's dropping a minute or whatever a right. day. Can I extend my time of daylight by driving north or south? I think you could by driving north.
Yeah, but there's a limit. This is a really good question. You could do it for a while, but on September 21st, every place on Earth gets just 12 hours. So long before September 21st, there's no place to hide. You can't find a spot on Earth. At least you'd have to jump 10,000 miles or something to get there. But for a while in the summertime, if you keep driving north, that daylight length is going to last. But the interesting thing is, and Steve will amplify this easily, the interesting thing is, as you drive north to keep 15 hours of daylight for a while in the summer, you lose intensity, right?
Right, yep.
Yeah, so that's kind of the interesting thing. The length of day isn't the whole story. It's the combination of length of day and the intensity that drives the climate.
Intensity of the light. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I agree with John, and we came to the same conclusion, John, that you could go north for a little while and maintain with about 14 or 15 hours, whatever it is that we have.
Mm.
But at some point, it would catch up with you.
Yeah.
And then, because between us and down to the equator always gets 12 hours. So between us and the equator right now, you'd be getting less daylight hours.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, we're all in the northern hemisphere getting less as the southern hemisphere gets more. So eventually it would catch up to us.
Yeah.
And then we would be really cold.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Brian and Madison, we'll go turn to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, I have the actual numerical answer to the question.
Oh, you did?
I spitballed some of the numbers, like the diameter or the circumference of the Earth and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But if you assume there's 25, the Earth is 25,000 miles around, which is pretty close, 360 degrees, that's 69 miles per degree. The sun varies by about 46.5 degrees over the course of a year, meaning that you would have to travel about 18.2473 miles a day in order to keep your current amount of daylight.
Excellent!
So you just back of the envelope that with four digits. Is that four decimal points there?
Yeah, I like that, Brian.
All right.
Thanks for doing the math on that. All right.
So you could walk it every day for a while.
You're
I
good,
think that's
right.
going to change the higher latitude you go. It can't be the same. It can't be the same every day because the angle of inclination is changing rapidly at certain times of year.
Oh, right, yeah.
Jack in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. You guys have talked about lightning a lot and about that you should never be in a low or an open place. And you hear about golfers and all kind of people that get hit by lightning. But I've never heard of a boater, a fisherman, or anyone in Wisconsin, on our inland lakes, Lake Michigan and Superior, possibly not, that has ever been hit by lightning. Have you, and are there any documented reports?
Hmm.
I don't know of any, and I would attest it to the intelligence of the Wisconsin people. Get off
because,
the lake.
Because everybody always says, get off the lakes, you know, if you're fishing or something when there's lightning, yet I've never in all my years heard of anybody getting hit by lightning in a boat on inland lakes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't say that I have either, but I think I agree with Steve. I think it's because people who are out in the outdoors a lot, and fishermen are, they're going to be extremely attentive to that kind of thing, and they know that it's dangerous. And certainly not without merit, but luckily perhaps without statistic.
Right.
Yeah, but you would think golfers, or maybe golfers aren't very smart because they get hit all the time, it seems.
Well, we know a really smart golfer who, having a great round recently, decided to throw caution to the wind.
Thanks, Jack. Appreciate the call. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. I have, though, there have been times, actually, you know what I rely on when I'm golfing?
Mm-hmm.
I rely on the golf course itself, because every golf course that I play on has a siren.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And so if the siren goes off, I'm out of there.
Okay, unless the clubhouse attendant's watching ESPN, right, instead of the Weather Channel.
If the siren goes off, I am out of there in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
Dick in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I hope my question is interesting, too. It has to do with the Louisiana wetlands, what's left of them.
Hmm.
I read a book by Mike Tidwell called Bayou Farewell, and that's where I got most of my knowledge. But they're shrinking, and my understanding is that as the hurricanes come across the Gulf toward New Orleans, or anywhere. They're sucking up energy from the warm waters, and when they hit the wetlands, why, they can't suck up energy, and the strength of the hurricanes diminishes. However, they're, as I say, they're shrinking, and you probably know that better than I do, and in maybe 50 years there won't be any. And I wonder if you know of anything that's being done to try to get some of the Mississippi River silt-laden water back into the wetlands where it belongs.
I know after Katrina this was a major issue that was brought to the fore among many others, and this is one that we could very well have a larger control over. First of all, what you say about hurricanes approaching the Louisiana coast is true. They do, when they hit the wetlands, it's sort of a middle ground between being out over the open ocean and being over the land. And as soon as a hurricane gets over the land, squarely over the land, it often does rather rapidly decrease in intensity. So as it hits the wetlands of Louisiana, it certainly experiences some decrease in its ability to intensify. And in addition, the wetlands absorb a lot of that storm surge. Because they are an object in the water, and it's not just the water itself. And so that's another way to protect coastal Louisiana, actual land coastal Louisiana, not just the wetlands. I am unaware myself, because I'm ignorant of the issue, of how those wetlands have been impacted and for what reasons. I think some of it has been the way that the Mississippi's been diverted and various other things, well within our control to change. And we absolutely should do that to make that. That's a very important natural resource for the state of Louisiana, and it is being decimated. Steve, what do you know about that?
I know that the way that we've been controlling the Mississippi has affected the way that that whole Delta region has developed, as opposed to how it would develop naturally. And I agree with you that after Katrina, now this has really raised the issue again. I mean, it's always been an issue, but with the Katrina now, we're relooking at that whole wetlands areas. And I think people are talking about it, but I don't know of any programs that are underway that are really trying to do something about it.
Thanks for calling, Dick. Appreciate it. Ron in West Bend, it's your turn now. Hi, Ron.
Yes, here's the answer on lightning striking aluminum boats. Huh. It's firmly engraved in my mind. Around 86 to 90, there were two canoeists on one of the lakes, or the lake, in Governor Dodge State Park, and they got directly hit by lightning. I don't remember if both of them were killed or just one. But the reason that I remember it so vividly, I was on the east branch of the Milwaukee River between Mothy Lake and New Fane on the same afternoon, and the same storm came through, and we sat it out on the edge of the riverbank, getting bit up by mosquitoes, but we stopped where there was a radio tower about a quarter mile west of us, and we figured the radio tower was going to get it before we did.
That's a good idea.
Wow.
But here's the thing, you know, Governor Dodge, it's down in a bowl, and they still got hit out in the middle of the lake with a canoe.
Yeah.
Get off the water if you got a chance.
Good advice.
Thank you very much for calling. Marvin Menominee, your turn. Hi, Marvin.
Good morning, Larry and guests. I'm calling about the very same issue. This weekend, in fact, in the local paper here, I believe it was the Eau Claire Leader, was a photo and accompanying story of some men who were just in the past week up in Lower Canada fishing on a lake as a storm approached. They thought the storm was a couple miles away, yet they could see the thunder and lightning and the thunderheads. So they made a beeline for shore. The next thing they knew, they were all knocked to the bottom of the boat. They couldn't hear anything. And the fishing rod that took the bolt of lightning was nothing but a bundle of fibers and pieces of equipment.
Wow.
And they showed a picture of that. It was just shredded as if it went through a sieve. And they figured the lightning bolt hit that rod, traveled through the gunwale of the boat, through the front of the boat, down into the water through a rope that was hanging in the water. Completely missed the men. Wow. But you can imagine what would have happened to them. For the next 20 minutes, they couldn't hear each other. It was quite a story.
Marvin, what paper was that in?
The Eau Claire Leader, I think.
I want to say it was either the Eau Claire Leader or the Dunn County News. I read them both yesterday morning, and I just can't remember which one it was in, but probably the Eau Claire Leader. But the big story or the big lesson there is, even though that storm appears to be a couple miles away, that lightning is far ahead of it in that cloud mass that's coming towards you. That lightning can jump for miles in one direction.
Yeah, yeah. You just can't take it lightly. You just can't. Exactly right.
Yeah, there is this thing called a lightning out of the blue. And so if there's a thunderstorm that's nearby, you can, on rare situations, the lightning can come out the top of the cloud and then come down. So, you know, it's blue skies over you, and you can see the thunderstorm, and it can come and hit you.
You bet.
Yeah.
It's fun to play with.
Yeah, thanks, Marv.
You're welcome, Larry.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, with your own question, comment, or story at 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions or comments. You do hear this story about if you're struck by lightning or a tornado in a spot, that you're then probably that's not going to happen again.
That's a statement that's based upon the statistical, hope and the statistical near impossibility of being hit either case for the first time. But a famous counterexample exists in 1947. I think it was late March or early April 1947. Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma, right outside Oklahoma City, I think it is, was hit by a tornado. And a large part of the, there were a lot of airplanes out on the runways and whatnot, and they got destroyed. Within 10 days, another massive tornado hit the exact same spot. And this was actually the impetus for the United States Air Force to start its tornado project, which was to try and understand what are the meteorological conditions that lead to tornado formation. And this was under the leadership of, I don't know what his rank was, captain or somebody else, Miller. And it came up with what's called Miller's Rules for tornado forecasting. And these are still taught to people who learn about severe weather because they're very solid empirical-based rules. We've learned other things about tornado formation since then, but the Miller Tornado Project 60 years ago started the entire modern knowledge of tornadoes, and it was a result of a double hit at Tinker Air Force Base. So it can happen.
It can happen, and Jim Packard dug out one for me on, I think it was Codell, Kansas, struck by tornadoes on the same day in three consecutive years.
Wow.
That was 1916, 1917, and 1918.
Wow. During World War One, people must have thought the world was coming to an end.
Boy, oh boy.
Amazing.
Boy. Tom, and talk about bad luck. You wonder how many people decided in 1918 to get the heck out of town.
Incredible.
Tom in Green Bay, hello to you.
Afternoon. Where are you? Fish a lot.
I'm sorry, we didn't hear you.
You fish a lot, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Up here. Sorry, I lost you here. So,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry we lost you. Fishing. I tell you what, I get off the water.
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah.
I do not stay out on the water.
It's too scary.
I remember a humorous time. I was out fishing on a big body of water in northern Wisconsin. There were a couple of other boats out there, friends of mine, and so the storm started to come, and we hightailed it, and the other boat took off in the other direction. You know, they were quite a ways away from us, and I said, "Where are they going?" And my buddy said, "Well, maybe they're just going to take one more pass along the shoreline." Well, in fact, what they'd done was they got goofed up on directions and headed the opposite way. So they went a ways and then turned around and then they came in as fast as they could. Yeah. A 20-horse motor will take you. Mm. And they came in with a storm right over the top of them, and they were a couple of scared guys by the time they got in. It didn't take long to get out of the boat and get to shore and get to shelter. Stephen St. Germain, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have an incident that happened about 3 years ago in the Eagle River chain where a couple was out fishing and it was clear blue skies with a storm coming, and the lady in the back of the boat got hit by lightning when her graphite pole through her body. Her husband tried to start the motor, took the gasoline motor out. Mm. Luckily, his electric motor worked. He got to shore and got an ambulance, and she survived. But she had the complications from that hit.
Jeez.
Wow.
She was holding onto her rod?
She was holding on. They were fishing with a graphite rod, and the storm was probably still about 5 miles away when she got hit.
Wow.
That's a good plug for learning CPR.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Steve, for sharing that. Appreciate it. Oh, boy. Yeah, that is a very good plug for learning CPR. Fred in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Fred.
Yes, hello. Say, I think the short-term temperature forecasts are excellent, but what impacts me the most is whether there will be precipitation or not in the next day or so. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could comment on what I sometimes hear in the winter. They'll say 2 to 4 inches of snow expected, and then chance of snow, 80%. I would think if it's an 80% chance, they might say 0 to 4 inches expected, or if it's 2 to 4, they might say 100% chance of snow. It's vague.
Mm-hmm. That probability forecast for whether or not it's going to precipitate or not sometimes can mean two different things. The way I understand it, it most often should mean the following thing, that on 4 days out of five with the same conditions that we're anticipating for tomorrow, in the case you bring up, they should get some snow out of that kind of set of conditions. Only one of those 5 days, you might end up with not much. The alternative way to look at it is 80% of the area for which the forecast is issued is likely to receive snow on that day. Now, I wish there weren't confusion about that, because there's confusion in my own mind about what's actually meant when someone issues that forecast, and I don't know what the standard meaning is. But that can be part of what confuses a person when they hear that forecast. And it's interesting also that in the wintertime, when it's snow falling, is the only time that the meteorologist is charged with telling you the amount of precipitation and not just the likelihood of it. And that makes the challenge a little bit higher, because the impact is higher. So,
but Fred is also right in the sense that the precipitation forecasts are not as good as the temperature forecasts yet.
That's correct.
We've got to find a way to make those better.
That's absolutely right, especially true in the summertime.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fred.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Well, I'm looking ahead to the weekend on Saturday. Several people from Wisconsin Public Radio's listening audience will be at our home.
Oh, yeah.
For a nice event. And I'm looking ahead, and I'm seeing the long-term forecast is for a beautiful day on Saturday.
I think that I would agree with that as I sit here this morning. I think it's going to be... The heat will be done by about the end of the day tomorrow. We'll have a couple of days of pretty warm and muggy, and then it'll come back to low 80s, a little bit drier, and it'll feel great. So it should be a pretty nice week and a good weekend.
I sure hope so. Dick in Cross Plains, hi to you.
Hi. These fellows are faculty members, and therefore I assume they have research projects or they supervise PhD types.
Correct.
I'm just curious if each one of them could maybe tell us the 2 or 3 or 4 primary research project titles or names or areas they're working on right now.
That's good.
Sure.
Good question.
Steve, you want to go ahead?
Boy.
You got more than me. Maybe I'll give you time to think about it.
I'll name two science one and an education one that I'm working on. I work a lot with NASA and NOAA in looking at, you know, the current new satellites. And so we're looking particularly one from NASA where they just launched a LIDAR. And the LIDAR allows you to do vertical profiling through clouds. And that was launched about a year ago, and we're now have enough data, and the quality of data is good enough that we're actually doing some really interesting research with that. And then also with NOAA, we're trying to look at the next generation geostationary satellites. So the satellite you see every night on the evening news, we're finding new ways to actually make that a lot better. And then I'm working with... the National Science Foundation in developing a climate change course that's geared for teachers, so teaching teachers about climate change, and we're framing it around the IPCC recent report that just came out, so trying to find a way to explain what they're saying and how they arrived at their conclusions.
Cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, John?
Yeah, I got a couple of interesting things going on. One of them is I got a student who's looking at the transition of what's originally an extratropical cyclone into a tropical cyclone. That happens once or twice a year in the Atlantic Basin, and it's poorly understood. So we're looking at that, which is very interesting. It has connections to weather in the middle latitudes at all times of year. We're also about to look at the role of the lower stratosphere in producing weather in our troposphere where we live. This has been long neglected, and I think we're going to learn some pretty interesting things by looking at that. I'm also involved in understanding the precipitation distribution in wintertime storms that affect us here in Wisconsin. And also, I have this really neat little project I'm trying to finish up, but I'm not quite done with it yet. In late February, there was a tremendous dust storm in West Texas and all the way into eastern Texas. Closed down the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, 90,000 people lost power, and they had wind gusts at the surface over 80 miles per hour. And we're trying to figure out whether or not this had something to do with what we call upper-level fronts that hang off of the tropopause. They started about 9 kilometers above the ground and reached down to about 2. They don't quite hit the surface. And yet, I think this was the reason that this massive dust storm occurred. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at that, trying to understand how that happened. So lots of interesting things going on, both in for both of our research, but the department as a whole, it's just a fascinating place to be. There's a lot happening.
Yeah, that was a great question. Thank you, Dick. I should have asked that question myself a long time ago, for goodness sake. Well, you're going to have to keep us up to date on what you find in these projects.
Yeah, I'm almost done with that one, but not yet.
We got an email, and I want to have you quickly comment on it. John, you saw the photo that a person took. It was Terry in La Crosse in a northern Wisconsin, Vilas County Lake. And the photo is of some clouds that almost look funnel-like. They're white clouds.
Yeah. They're these beautiful cumulonimbus, Steve. You should see these pictures. You got to take a look at them sometime. Beautiful cumulonimbus. I think there was a string of 3 of them,
yes.
She reported. And what's happening there is that the core of that cloud is just where the air is rising and condensing the water vapor out of it, forming both liquid water and ice, and that's what gives it its cloud shape. And then it hits the top of the troposphere, the part of the atmosphere we live in, and it's just going to spread out on the top. And this, we call them anvil clouds. They look like anvils, but they also have that funnel shape. You're right, because they're wider at the top than they are at the bottom.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of the clouds that you look at if you're on the lake fishing. You say, time to get off the lake. Or if you're on the golf course, time to get off the golf course if they're too close to you, because they can be associated with severe weather, and particularly they can spawn a tornado. Although conditions that don't necessarily translate to the appearance of the cloud are going to dictate whether or not there's tornadic possibility. You can't always know by looking at the picture.
Great show, guys. Thank you so much for being with us. Hey, have fun, Steve, on the rest of your trip.
All right, it will do.
Yeah, see you next week, Steve.
Thanks very much. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys, and they will be back the last Monday of July, and we'll talk with them some more about climate and weather. And thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.